The Hoop Heads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball. Hello and welcome to the debut edition of the Hoop Heads Podcast. On today's podcast, Coach Jason Sunkel will be interviewing me, Mike Klinzing, the founder of Head Start Basketball, just to give you a little background on me and the reasons why I started Head Start Basketball and a little bit about my basketball background. I'll flip it over here to Jason and he'll start with question one and we'll get rolling.
All right. What is your first basketball memory from when you were a kid or whatever?
Well, I have lots of pictures of me when I was really little, dunking on the Nerf hoop and doing those kinds of things. And obviously my dad was the person that first introduced me to the game. And actually he was my coach for a long time on the driveway and then also in the summertime. My first actual basketball memory kind of involves my first grade birthday. And I remember that for my first grade birthday party, I had some friends come over. And my birthday's in March, and it was cold, and we all had jackets on. But I wanted us to be outside playing basketball. And I remember me and my friends outside on the driveway playing basketball. And we have a picture, again, of me and my friends all kind of with our hand in on the ball, kind of like we were ending a timeout. And so I remember that. And then my first basketball player that I really liked was Dr. J. And so I can remember being a kid back when basketball wasn't on as much as it is now, watching games and then going out on the driveway and trying to emulate the moves that I would see the players make, and specifically Dr. J. And obviously I can't jump nearly as well as Dr. J can, but to say the least. But by the same token, those are the moves that I tried to get out there and emulate. So those are my earliest memories of basketball. And then from there, played a lot of rec basketball, which is different from the type of basketball that we play today with AAU and travel. Just played in the community rec leagues back in that time. And I remember being excited about that and playing at my elementary school as well. We had a sixth grade team that traveled to one of the other elementary schools in Strongsville and had a chance to play against the other team. I remember that being a huge, huge deal.
Rivalry?
Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore. That's something that, you know, I wish that was more prevalent than it is today. Unfortunately, we have the system that's set up, which we'll probably talk about in a future podcast, but the system was a little bit different back then.
Awesome. All right. I guess this kind of perfectly goes into the next question. Where did you play high school basketball and college basketball, and like talk a little bit about your career?
Sure. So I played basketball at Strongsville High School. I graduated in 1988, which is now a long, long time ago. Hard to believe how long ago that was.
I was two.
You were two. So a little bit of an age disparity, a little age difference there. And when I was at Strongsville, the schools were set up a little bit differently than they are today. Most schools today are set up with a middle school model where you have grades 6, 7, and 8 together and then 9 through 12 in high school. And when I was in high school, we had a junior high model, so I went to elementary school up through 6th grade. And then in 7th grade, the junior highs didn't even have a team. So in my quest to look around and try to find something to do, a way to play, I actually played at St. Joseph and John's and had to go to CCD class in order to be eligible to play at St. Joe's, just because at what was Center Middle School in Strongsville, we didn't even have a team in 7th grade. So then in 8th grade, played at center for Coach Ken Schifferle. And then in 9th grade, where in today's world I would have been at the high school, back in that time I was at the junior high and played 9th grade for Bill Siz. And our teams we had really good teams both of those years. Proud to say we never lost to our crosstown rival Albion. And then from there, I went on to the high school, where I was fortunate enough as a 10th grader to play on a very good varsity team. I was the sixth man for that team. I don't think I started a game all year. Probably averaged about maybe 6 points a game, something like that. Probably played, I don't know, 16 minutes a game, so about half. And I remember that being kind of a difficult situation to break into, in that I was younger than the other guys who were on the team, and they had kind of been established, and they are obviously very good. And so to have a younger kid kind of come in and try to break into that lineup was, I think, a little bit of a challenge for them at times to figure out how to best incorporate me, not just into the actual basketball on the floor, but friendships and that kind of thing. So that was definitely a challenging year in terms of figuring all that out. And we ended up having a very good season that year. And then my next 2 years, as a junior, we had a very good team. We won what was the Pioneer Conference at that time. And then when I was a senior, we actually didn't win the conference for the first time in my high school career. We lost to Brecksville twice that year and ended up going, I think we were 17-3 during the regular season. And then we lost to Lorain Admiral King in the district semifinals in the state tournament. And that's a whole other story that I can that I could share. It kind of goes into with my college career. So we played Lorain Admiral King, and at the time they were, the USA Today had a national high school ranking system, and they were ranked, I think they were ranked 11th in the country at the time.
How did they even do that? Like,
I have no idea.
Especially with the, like, there was no way to watch like we do now.
No,
like,
I think, yeah, you couldn't watch anything on the internet, obviously. So it was more, I think, a case of you had local beat writers that were kind of plugged into these high school, you know, different areas, and then those people would come together and nominate or vote or talk about, you know, who are the college prospects on these various teams, and then you'd end up with this ranking system. So I'm sure it was very, very flawed, but nonetheless, it was something that me and my teammates certainly read about and heard about. We're like, these guys are 11th in the country, you know, 11th in the country, and we felt like we were there every bit their equal, and we ended up playing them, like I said, in the district semifinals. We were the number 2 seed. They were the number 1 seed, and they decided to jump onto Lorain's. They wanted to go avoid Lorain Senior High, which doesn't exist anymore, and neither does Admiral King, for that matter. I guess Lorain Senior exists, but Lorain Admiral King doesn't. Those two schools merged, and they didn't want to play Lorain. They wanted to play us, so that was another bit of motivation for us. And so Admiral King ended up having my future college teammate, Harold Walton, that was on the team. And they also had Jamie Gladden, who ended up playing at Xavier. So they had some obviously very talented players. And we played them even all through the game and came down to the last, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds of the game. And we had the ball. And I drove into the key and spun, got fouled. Made a shot, so we were up 2, got fouled on the shot, there was a timeout, went to the bench, sitting on the bench, and I remember my coach, Bob Casey, saying, well, if Mike makes the free throw, here's what we do. And I remember looking at him going, I'm definitely going to make the free throw, so let's not plan for the alternative of if I miss. And I did make the free throw, and so then Admiral King had to go the length of the floor, 3 seconds, to get a 3 to try to tie the game. And I'll never forget the play, because they threw the ball into half court and I was guarding the guy who caught the ball, and he threw it one more pass down to Jamie Gladden in the corner. So I was standing in half court looking directly down the sideline at the 3-point line and could clearly see Jamie Gladden's 2 feet planted firmly right on the line, meaning that when he shot the ball it was a 2, and whether it went in or not wouldn't have mattered. And he shot it. He made it. There were rumors from other people that were at the game that another guy on their team had goaltended the ball. I never saw that. But there was an official standing on the baseline right next to Gladden when he shot it. And that guy did not call it a 3. And then there was a guy at half court all the way across the floor who, when the shot went in, he came running across the court signaling for a 3. So both teams' fans were out on the floor, because our fans thought it was a 2 and that the game was over, and their fans thought it was a 3 and that it went to overtime. And it obviously ended up getting ruled a 3, and then it went to overtime.
Where were those replay reviews?
We needed the replay review. There's no, to my knowledge, there was no footage, because the only footage that I ever saw did not show Gladden's feet. So you couldn't tell whether or not it was true. So Harold Walton, who played at Admiral King and became my teammate for 4 years, he and I went back and forth on this over and over and over and over. And it was one of those things that, it just, again, there's no answer to it, but it's probably it's probably the most difficult loss that still, to this day, it sticks with me more than any other, probably more than any other game I've ever played in my life. They ended up going to, Admiral King ended up going down to the state Final Four, and they lost to the eventual champions, who was Columbus, Lyndon McKinley. So last thing about that game, after Harold and I became teammates at Kent, he said that before the game, his coach had told them that, you know, I was way better than anybody they had on their team, and I was going to be going to Kansas State. So he said they're all like, oh, this guy's going to Kansas State. He's, you know, he thinks he's really good. So that was, again, something that we kind of joked about as I eventually, you know, made my
way.
Were
you thinking of going to Kansas State, or was that not a...
No, Kansas State was not on the radar at all. So I recruited myself to Kent State. So, again, another sort of interesting story of how things transpired. So when I was in the fall of my senior year, and this kind of goes to show you, again, how limited, A, my knowledge was of the recruiting process, and just the fact that, again, we didn't have information at our fingertips in the same way. At that time, now you could just, you know, hop on the internet and figure out the answers to these questions. But at the time, we didn't really know. And so what happened was, in the fall of my senior year, Kent called me, and there was a couple other schools that I was talking to, but Kent called me, and they said, we want you to come down for a visit. And at that point, I still thought that I was under the mistaken impression that I was going to get a call from Ohio State or North Carolina or Duke or whatever. And so I told Kent, I said, yeah, I'll come down for a visit, but I don't want you to pay for anything, because I don't want to, I didn't say waste, but basically I didn't want to waste one of my, you know, official visits on Kent, because I wanted to save them for all the, you know, big power schools that were going to be coming, you know, come calling. And obviously those schools never called. So anyway, I went down, I went to Kent, and actually went with my mom, and they didn't pay for anything. I remember going to lunch at Wendy's with my mom as part of the recruiting visit. And then that was pretty much the end of Kent's recruitment of me. During the season, never heard from him, never came and saw me play. And then with about 3 or 4 games left in the season, I was still talking to Cleveland State, because my dad taught there, and I had been told that I could walk on by Kevin Mackey, and that maybe eventually I'd get a scholarship. I was also talking to St. Francis of Pennsylvania, and talking a little bit to Bob Huggins at Akron, but no offers had come in at that point. So I called Kent back, and I said, hey, are you still interested? And they said, yeah, we're still interested. And they ended up coming and see me play a game against Brunswick, which was my last home game as a senior. And in that game, I ended up hitting about a 35-footer at the buzzer of overtime to win that game in my last home game. But Coach McDonald, who was my coach at Kent, had already left, so he didn't see probably the best basketball moment of my career. He was already gone. But at that point, they ended up, after the season was over, they ended up offering me a scholarship. So I was the 7th scholarship player to be offered in our class of 7 freshmen that ended up going into Kent. I was clearly player number 7. All the other 6 guys had already signed by the time I got my offer and ended up signing. So that's how I ended up at Kent.
Cool. What was your basketball practice regimen when you played high school and college?
So I had a couple different things that I used to do. And it's interesting, because if I look at the way basketball training and practice goes today, it's so different from just the knowledge and what was out there when I was, when I was a kid, and then obviously when I was playing in high school and in college. And basically I did the same workout if I was by myself. I did the exact same workout every single day. So it involved some moves off the dribble. It involved some one dribble jumpers. It involved free throws. It involved shooting threes off the catch and off the dribble. But I had a set routine that I did every single day. And then if I had a partner, if I had somebody that I was working out with, then I usually tried to do the same thing with them, where, you know, again, they're rebounding, and we would do, we would do different things, but we had some set things that we always did. And so if I look at now the variety of different training methods and things that are out there in terms of the variety of drills and ball handling and shooting drills, and just there's just so much more knowledge out there from coaches. And I was a kid who I think probably would have eaten all that stuff up and really enjoyed the variety, but at the time that just wasn't the way it was. So I did my old style Pete Maravich ball handling drills, and I did my and I did my shooting workout, and again it was pretty much the same. I mean, I'm guessing through probably by the time I got to high school all the way through college, that workout was pretty much the same thing I did all the time. It didn't vary very much at all.
Cool. Okay, I didn't prep you on this question, but I want to ask it.
All right.
I want you to settle a long-standing question that me and Coach Steve Frame have had, I think, conversations about for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. If European basketball was as popular as European basketball is now back when you played, do you think you would have played over there, overseas, like after your college career?
I think that's a great question. I would like to say the answer is yes, because it was a different time. But by the same token, I'm not sure that, you know, I would have had the opportunity. It's hard really to know. When I look back at what the opportunities that I did have, when I got done with Kent, I went to two tryouts that were theoretically for, or could have led to some type of professional basketball. So one was a camp in Cincinnati that was advertised. I forget where I even saw it, but you would go down to this camp in Cincinnati and they were going to pick an all-star team from the people who were attending this camp. And then this all-star team was going to travel around Europe. And in the course of playing on this all-star team, European clubs could then see you play. And then that would be how you would be offered a contract, by them seeing you play as you're traveling with this team. So that was the premise that it was sold on. And so after I signed up and paid my money and got to Cincinnati, you found out that they had 11 of their 12 spots were already full, and they were looking to add a big man, 6'9" or taller. And the rest of the people that were there were supposed to submit their press clippings and articles and statistics, and then they were going to spread that around to their contacts in European basketball. So needless to say, that never happened, right? They took our money, and nothing, to my knowledge, ever happened as a result of that. And then my dad and I went to a tryout in Detroit for the Global Basketball League, which was a startup league at the time that I forget who was running it. But the tryout was basically, I was the tallest guy there. It was a bunch of 5'6", 5'7" dudes that were running around dribbling. And so I never touched the ball that I can recall, because I was the biggest guy on the floor. So that turned out to be not a very worthwhile endeavor. So I look at the way basketball is today and just the prevalence of how there's so many more teams and it's so much more popular. I feel like at the time, the skill set that I had as a 6'3", non-athletic shooter really wasn't a very novel thing in European basketball. That's basically what European basketball was at the time.
Yeah.
And so now, I think there's just more demand for Americans because there's more teams. And so I like to think I'd at least had a chance to be able to go and maybe play a little bit. But again, there's nothing really concrete to base that on. I'd like to think that would be the case. But again, it wasn't something that, you know, materialized for me. And it kind of forced me to come back and move on with the rest of my life.
Thanks. Like I said, I didn't want to prep you on that one. How long have you been coaching basketball, and where have you coached before?
So I started, I guess, my coaching career while I was still playing, just working at different camps while I was a college player. So I worked at Ohio State for Gary Williams at his camp. I worked one week at the Michael Jordan Flight School, which was a lot of fun. Didn't get a chance to play against Michael, which usually the college guys that are there get a chance to play against them. But the night that he was scheduled to play with us, supposedly the rumor was that he was out gambling with former Bears coach Mike Ditka. That was the rumor. Now, whether or not that
Michael
was true,
Jordan gambling?
Michael Jordan gambling. that was the rumor. So I didn't get a chance to play on the court with him. I did get a chance to stand near him and watch him play one-on-one against some of the campers. So it was still a good experience, but definitely a regret that I never got to get on the court with him. I also coached at the University of Michigan's camp, worked at some other camps just around the area. Ron Harper used to have a basketball camp here in Cleveland that was run by Mel Termini, who is the brother of Mark Termini, who is the agent for LeBron that actually does all, he's the lawyer that does all the actual negotiating for Clutch Sports and all their clients that are part of that group. So that's what I started with, was just coaching at different camps. And then from there, when I graduated from college with a business degree, and then I decided I was going to go back to school to become a teacher, I worked my first year out of college. I was a volunteer assistant at Strongsville High School with the JV team. So I did that for 1 year. I was strictly a volunteer. And I worked with Jeff Eicher, who just recently left the girls' coaching position at Strongsville. And then from there, I went and worked 2 years in Bay Village. The first year was for Rich Voyers, who was a longtime coach at Bay Village, had a lot of great teams, produced a ton of great players. And then the following year, his assistant, Dick Scott, took over, and I stayed on as the JV coach. So that was 2 years. Then, from there, at that point, I had finished my my coursework to become a teacher and get my teacher certificate. So I looked around for teaching jobs, and I had two offers on the table. One was to be a study hall monitor and the varsity head coach at North Royalton High School. And my other offer was to go to Richmond Heights and become the varsity assistant, but have a full-time teaching position, teaching third grade. So it was a hard decision, but I ended up opting for the teaching job in Richmond Heights that was full-time, and ended up being a varsity assistant at Richmond for 15 years. For the first 13, we had the same staff, just a great group of guys. And the one thing I do miss about high school coaching is just the camaraderie and hanging out in the locker room and hanging out with the coaches. That's probably what I miss more than anything. Now that I'm not doing that, I'm focused more on the camps and training side of the business.
All right. When did you start Head Start Basketball, and why did you start it?
So Head Start Basketball began, my first year was the summer of 1993, which was not the first summer that I got out of school, but the second summer. And I started it as a result of actually my friendship with Scott Roth, who at the time, he's a graduate of Brecksville High School and the University of Wisconsin. And he ended up playing in the NBA for a number of years, probably never more than the 11th or 12th man on any team. And then he spent a bunch of years playing in Europe. Right now he's the coach of the T-Wolves G League team in Iowa. But Scott had a camp in Strongsville, and he and I had become friends. Kind of a funny story. He was where the police station, where the library is now in Strongsville, used to be where the courts were. And I was up there one day in the middle of the afternoon. It was, 85 degrees, and I was probably, 13 or 14 up there by myself. And Scott was driving by in his Mercedes and pulled into the parking lot and got out and came over and told me he was looking for somebody to play one-on-one full court against him. He needed somebody with a lot of energy and stamina to make him work. And so at that time, he was at the University of Wisconsin. He was probably 21, and I was, like I said, 13 or 14 maybe. And so he and I got to become friends and played a lot of one-on-one full court and, got to know him, and he played on summer teams with him and all that kind of stuff. But Scott had a camp at Strongsville. Probably this was when he was, maybe 4 or 5 years into his NBA career at that point. And he ended up getting, I forget how many kids there were, maybe he had 70 kids or 80 kids at this camp at the high school. And I remember thinking that, he was pretty far removed at that point. He was, 10 years removed probably from his, from his high school days at Brecksville. So, and he wasn't really a very well-known NBA player because he was a 12th man. He was an end-of-the-bench guy. And so I thought that, wow, if his name could generate and get 70 or 80 kids, and, he's a Brecksville guy and not really that well-known necessarily in Strongsville, I thought, why don't I, instead of working for somebody else, why don't I try and, start my own thing? And so that's what I did. And my first idea was to run a neighborhood camp. So I went to each of, at the time, there was 7 elementary schools. And so I went and ran a camp at each one of the elementary schools. And I remember one of the camps I had 25 kids, and another one of the camps I had 10, and then the rest of them were somewhere in between that. And so I did 7 different weeks of camp, and it was basically me and my friends at the time that worked the camp. And you know, again, we were young and just kind of trying to figure it out as we were going along, how to make it, how to make a camp positive for the kids, and yet at the same time, a lot of what we were doing, we were just having fun ourselves. So that was kind of the initial idea, and we did it for 1 year at the elementary schools, and then after that, I had a conversation with the athletic director at the time, Joe Lynch, who eventually became the basketball coach at Strongsville High School. And we just decided that it would probably be easier and more effective to move the camp to, I think we actually went to Center Middle School the first year. And so then we cut back from what had been 7 weeks of camp. We cut it down to 2 weeks with a morning session, afternoon session. So in essence, it was 4 camps. And that proved to be a good decision, both from a time utilization standpoint, and also just, again, we had a better facility with more baskets, and you know, it just made the camp a lot better. And then gradually
the hot box.
Yeah, it was very warm. It was very warm there. And then we had the upstairs small like auxiliary gym that had a stage, and it was super hot in there. And but it was a lot of fun. I mean, again, at that point, again, as the camp started to grow year by year, it was just a lot of fun to see it grow. And at that point, I was teaching. So it was just a summer job. It was something that I loved to do. I was back in the community where I grew up. And so that was really the whole idea behind where Head Start Basketball came from.
Awesome. All right. I have one more question. What do you think the most important fundamental to teach the youth learning basketball is prior to them actually playing?
So I'm going to cheat on your question and
give you more than one thing.
I think initially out of the gate, as far as a basketball skill goes, we're talking about kids who are 5, 6, 7 years old. I think the most important thing that they can learn in terms of a basketball skill is being able to handle the ball. So being able to dribble it so that they can get where they want to go on the court. Most of those kids, unfortunately, don't have an opportunity to shoot on a lower basket, which would be tremendous, but in a lot of cases they don't. So really working on shooting at that age isn't the most important thing, in my opinion. In my opinion, working on their dribbling and their ability, again, to get where they want to go on the court is probably the most important thing. And then once you have that, you start transitioning into 9, 10, 11, then you start talking about the ability to shoot the basketball. And if you can shoot the basketball, there's always a spot for you, regardless of what your other skills are. So I think you start with the ball handling piece, and then you move to shooting. And then the third prong of that I'm going to add is something that we've made a huge push on at our camp every year. And I think it continues to become more and more important to me the older I get and the more I see and I'm around youth basketball today. And that's the sportsmanship piece, and just being a player that has character and knows how to be a good sport, both when they win and also when they lose. And so that's something that we really try to teach the kids. It's something that we really emphasize. We try to make sure that kids are good teammates, that they're good sports with the kids on their team, the kids on the other team, their coaches, the officials. And again, we hope that message gets across to the kids. And again, we hope it gets across to the parents, that kids share that. Because a lot of times, again, something we'll probably talk about in a future podcast, but unfortunately we see a lot of parents that don't necessarily follow those same sportsmanship edicts that we try to put out there for kids. So that's one of our goals, is to make the game better. And you do that by helping kids improve their basketball skills, but also by helping them to improve as people, so that they can apply the things that they learn in basketball as they go on in life.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing all that information and telling us a little bit about yourself.
That was a lot of fun. I enjoy getting the opportunity to tell a little bit of my backstory that people may not have heard. So thanks, everybody.
There was stuff in there that I didn't even know.
So all right, well, that's good. You know, everybody learned something. So hopefully, if you're out there listening and you've been to one of our camps, or your kids have been to one of our camps, maybe now you know a little bit more about the history of of where I'm coming from and where Head Start Basketball came from. And thanks for listening. We really appreciate you jumping on and listening to the Hoop Heads podcast. And we'll be back with an interview with Coach Jason Sunkel being interviewed on our next episode. Thanks for listening to the Hoop Heads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.